Hello, this is Rory Groves, and you are listening to a recording from the Grovestead Gathering. We made these recordings to serve as a fundraiser for our own family economy. If you would like to share this or listen to other recordings we've made, please visit our website at thegrovestead.com. Thanks for listening.
Chris, thanks for coming. This whole thing is kind of his fault, in a manner of speaking. I got to know Chris over the course of writing my book, and he was a tremendous resource for me. He was very encouraging and very helpful and helped me navigate some of the publishing uncertainties and things like that. Actually, we ended up at the same publisher for the first book, so that was just a roundabout way. But Chris was very helpful, and he came up for a conference a couple of years back, and I got to know him then in person. And one of the things that Chris was talking about was he kind of saw this movement of what we're doing, this family economy, this productive households. He kind of saw this as like the beginning of a new movement. And one of the things that was on his heart was, how do we just get these people together? You know, we can write books and we can give talks and we can do these different things. And Chris certainly does that, and he's devoted a lot of his life to that. But as in Chris's words, he said, it's around the campfire that the magic happens. And so he reached out to me and said, is there a way we could maybe use your farm, the Grovestead, as a site to host one of these things? So long story short, it didn't happen last year as we originally planned, but here we are another year later, and you're all here with us, and you're part of this movement, and it's really important, and it's going to change the future as we know it. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let me just say a quick introduction to Chris. Chris is a pastor, an author, and a speaker, and he talks on the subjects of household economies and many other biblical concepts of the family. He's written two books. One is Man of the House, How to Build a Shelter in a World That's Falling Apart, and War, Household and War for the Cosmos. I highly recommend both those books. He's got another one coming out very soon. Just missed it. Wasn't able to get it here soon. What's the name of the third?
In the House of Tom Bombadil.
In the House of Tom Bombadil. So some Lord of the Rings allusions there, and there will be some good stuff that he'll be sharing from each of his books here this weekend. He's giving three talks. So I'd like to introduce Chris without further ado, and thanks for coming out.
Thank you, Rory. It's really great to be with you, and thank you for coming out. We had a number of these events scheduled around the country, and then COVID hit, and they all canceled. I had a whole year worth of speaking engagements lined up, and my calendar just, in like 2 weeks, completely opened up. It's like, wow, I got time on my hands. Anyway, great to be here, and it's a lovely location. Thanks for hosting this, Rory and Becca. And anyway, I'm really glad to be here. Some folks that I've connected with that maybe we've known about each other because of connections in the church world or social media or anything. That's great. So I want to talk today about the recreational household and why I'm against it. And then tomorrow I'm going to be talking about how our houses reflect the household of God. That's actually ties in or is some of the material from that is drawn from my book, Household and the War for the Cosmos. This talk is largely material or things or themes developed from my book, Man of the House. The third talk is where I actually will be getting into Tom Bombadil and Goldberry. So if you're into Tolkien and have actually read the books, you know what I'm talking about. If you've just seen the movies, you're like, what's he talking about? Anyway, well, now what I do is, when I'm in my church and I'm preaching, I don't even use notes, generally speaking, just a very, little item or piece of paper to help me remember, something that, I might forget if I lose my place. But when I'm in a setting like this, I actually use a manuscript. And the reason I do that is I want to make sure I say everything I intend to say, but also so that if you would like to have a copy of what I'm saying, you can have it. So I'm going to actually get Rory the PDF for this talk. And if it's worthwhile in your mind, you can have it. If you don't like it, then you can burn it, that kind of thing. Anyway, So let me go ahead and launch into it. By the way, one of the things that's in the barn that's a great resource is this journal, Family in America. This is actually a journal that was established by Alan Carlson, a friend of mine. And it's this particular issue relates to many of the things that you'll be thinking about and talking about and hopefully learning about during the course of this weekend. So it's free. So I encourage you to pick it up. It's great stuff. Okay, well, let me go ahead and jump into the subject matter here. Once upon a time, the economy lived at home. Households were for work, and the people who lived in them were put to work. First, there were family farms, and in those days, all farming was family farming. And fathers led the way, and wives and children, and even grandparents and hired hands joined in. There's a marvelous scene at the end of Akira Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai. Have you ever seen The Seven Samurai? It's a great film. I encourage you to watch it or see it. Have you seen Magnificent Seven, the Western? The original Western with Yul Brynner is a lot better than the more recent Western with, I can't remember the guys that were in that one. But anyway, that film, The Magnificent Seven, was based on Seven Samurai. So it's the same storyline, which is kind of fun because Akira Kurosawa based Seven Samurai on Westerns. He had seen a lot of Westerns and had actually created the story of the Seven Samurai based on American Westerns. So what goes around comes around, I guess. But at the end of that film, everyone is back to work in the rice paddies after the samurai's work is done. So the samurai in the story, they protect this Japanese village from bandits. And when they defeat the bandits, everybody can get back to work. And in that scene, the men are beating out time on drums, and everyone is singing. The women are rhythmically shoving seedlings into the muck, and every child is toting and fetching. It's an image of families working together, like we seldom see anymore. And it wasn't just farmers who worked at home. Artisans did too. Bakers, smiths, cobblers, they all had their storefronts with workshops in the back. And upstairs, if they lived in the city, was for sleeping and eating and playing and all the things that we now call family time. So that goes to show it wasn't all work. But in those days, work and rest were separated more by time than by space. There were the rhythms of the day and of the week. One day in seven was set aside for attendance at God's house, where offerings were brought in and God's children sat down at his table to eat spiritual food. And we all know it wasn't heaven on earth. There were rivalries, rebellious sons, unfaithful wives, tyrannical fathers, but we still have all of those. So let's not disparage what they had and we lost. So in the beginning, it was all in the house, the whole economy. I put it that way because an economy was more than work. It was an order. The word economy is a compound word that comes to us from Greek. Oikos, meaning house, and nomos, meaning law. The economy, then, was the law of the house. And it was overseen by the paterfamilias, the father of the family. Now, almost no one thinks of the economy in those terms today. For most people, it doesn't even live at home. It's moved out into the open market. And gross domestic product has practically no connection to homes, at least on the production side of things. Except when it comes to new housing starts. The only thing that the market economy has for houses to do today is consume goods and services produced and owned by people someplace else. Now, here's something else to know. Throughout the world, in both the East and the West, households were also religious institutions. Pagan households served the gods, and connecting houses to the gods were the ancestors. And that meant that households were part of something very big. They were the low rung of the ladder that reached all the way up to the heavens. Now, Christians had more in common with their neighbors than you might suppose. There was the fifth commandment, of course, honor your father and your mother. But every role in a household was viewed through the lens of the Christian faith. And we see that with the household codes in Colossians and Ephesians. Here's just a couple of sentences from the household code in Colossians. Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. So the Lord is the point of reference when it came to every role in a household. In some sense, every role was performed so as to give service to God. So this brings me to the biblical teaching on the origin and the nature of the household. Now, Sigmund Freud believed that the confession, "I believe in God Almighty, the Father Almighty," was merely a projection of childish longings for security in an indifferent universe. But the Apostle Paul said it actually worked the other way around. So in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, we have these words. "For this reason," this is the Apostle Paul speaking, "I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named." Now, what's lost in this translation, this rendering into English, is Paul's wordplay. This actually makes sense in Greek. It makes no sense in English. And the reason it makes sense in Greek is because the Greek word for father, patera, is the basis for the Greek word for family, patria. So when Paul said that, he was actually playing with the words patria and patera, patera, patria. The basis for the word family is father. In other words, in Greek, you can't say family without saying father. Now, there's a radical thought. It's also where we get the words in English, patrimony, patriotism, and yes, patriarchy. So it isn't human beings who project a father into the heavens. According to the Apostle Paul, it's the Father in heaven who projects fathers and families down to earth. Now, as a practical matter, the nexus that formed a family in the biblical faith is the conjugal union of a husband and wife. And here's a seminal passage from Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 24. "Then the Lord God said, it is not good that the man should be alone." It's an interesting thing to note because that's the first time God says in the creation account, "not good." Up to that point, it's good, 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 not good. Not good for the man to be alone. "I will make him a helper fit for him. Now out of the ground, the Lord God had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them to the man to see what he would call them." By the way, the name Adam in Hebrew, it's actually Adama, but it's a wordplay on the Hebrew for dirt. So Adam actually means the dirt man or the earth man, just so you know. There's a lot of things going on in Scripture that are actually, you know, sort of drawing on that name that you might not, you know, sort of consider having anything to do with that account of creation and the making of Adam. But anyway, that's a whole other subject. Another book for another day. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was his name. The man gave names to all the livestock and to the birds of the heavens and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. So there's something implied here about the naming. Adam just didn't simply arbitrarily create names out of thin air. "I think I'll call you gobbledygook," you know, something like that. There was a perception, an ability to see the nature and form of the creature that was brought to him. And each animal that was brought to him, he saw that he was different. There was something about his nature that was distinct from the natures of all the creatures that were brought before him. He found nothing suitable, no one suitable to be a companion. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, he took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into the woman and brought her to the man. And he said, "This at last," in other words, recognition, "this is someone who shares my nature. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman because she was taken out of man." Now this is sui generis. Ever since, it's been men who have been taken out of women. We get started with the reverse. Now, the idiom, "one flesh," has been understood for time out of mind to mean the issue of children from a conjugal union. But it also meant a common life, a common wealth, a common future, and for my purposes here, a common work. So what happened? I have just described a lost world. I'm like somebody coming from the center of the earth with information about a lost civilization. They're still living the old way down there. How that world was lost is a well-known story among people who care to know, but it's remarkable how few people care to know. Generally, we've been told that we've progressed and that nothing was lost that was worth keeping anyway. Accordingly, progress gave us the Industrial Revolution and the revolution in thought that came before it that made it possible. And those revolutions drove productive work out of the house and into the workplace. Now, initially, whole families moved into the factories and the mines. This is one of the things that you were probably not told in your history of the United States, you know, course in junior college or wherever you had it. If you had, I don't know if they teach history anymore in college. But the reason why we have child labor laws and the reason why we have the kind of laws that we have today related to labor had to do with the fact that entire families moved into the factories or went into the mines. And why was that so? Because they had always worked together. It was unthinkable that dad would go off to work and everybody would stay home. Well, if dad's going to work, we're all going to work. And so they went to the factories, they went to the mines. In fact, I was in Fairmont, West Virginia a few years back at a camp that's actually built right over the old Fairmont mines, and they have photographs of the boys. These boys are like, I don't know if, now I'm dating myself, but do you remember the Bowery boys? You know, those old black and white, nobody, okay. But anyway, street toughs back in the day in the 30s and the 20s in the United States, the Bowery boys were stories, you know, short black and white comedies about these kids who were kind of street urchin types, you know, kids kind of lived down the street. All these boys, they must have been from the age of like maybe 10 to like 13 years of age, maybe even younger than that, just completely covered with soot. And you look at those boys and you say, those boys are hardened already. You know, they had the look in the eye. They had seen people die. You know, that's the world that they knew. This is early 20th century, late 19th century. Anyway, so the women and the children were sent back home. First wave feminism, in case you didn't know. But the men stayed. Now, you know the upside. Economies of scale, the division of labor, the harnessing of power that could never have occurred in the household economy. Those things gave us automobiles and air conditioning and antibiotics. And I confess that I like those things, and I want to keep them. But everything comes at a price, and those things cost us something. They cost us the productive household. And just so you know that I'm not making this all up, here's something from Alan C. Carlson's helpful study, Family Cycles, Strength, Decline, and Renewal in American Domestic Life, 1630 to 2000. Quote, in 1930, President Herbert Hoover created the President's Research Committee on Social Trends. Its 1933 report featured a chapter on family, authored by University of Chicago sociologist William Ogburn. Now, if you know anything about sociology, his name should ring a bell. He was huge in the history of sociology. He contrasted the old family system, which had been, quote, in his words, this is William Ogburn, the chief economic institution, the factory of the time, the main education institution, end of quote, with a new order where, here's Ogburn again, quote, the factory has displaced the family, end of quote. Gone from the home were the array of activities that had defined the subsistence family economy: sewing, canning, baking, laundering, most cooking, health care, child care, care of the elderly, security, education, amusement, recreation, and religious activities. All had passed or were passing to industrial organized entities, be they corporate, state, or charitable in nature. American homes were now merely, this is Ogburn in the report, merely parking places for parents and children who spend their active hours elsewhere. So now you know that as early as 1933, the federal government thought of your home as merely a parking place. Now there are consequences. To build our Babel, where everything is possible, we had to deconstruct the household. And since that's where we used to live, we had to deconstruct ourselves. To reach the heavens that we can see, we've had to trade in the heavens that we can't see. Questions such as, is it true? Is it good? Is it beautiful? What does God say? are now considered irrelevant. They may even be considered oppressive. And the human form no longer informs us, since we'd rather it be without form and void, so that we can make ourselves into whatever we please. Women no longer look to their bodies to find a purpose to serve, and men increasingly don't either. So now we're suspended in midair, cut off from transcendent values, heaven, and our own bodies, the earth, carried along by every wind of doctrine blowing from places like Harvard or Wall Street or Hollywood. And this is one reason we are looking for meaning through consumption. And it's why our homes have been transformed into recreation centers, which perversely have fewer members and more floor space than ever. Ironically, when the economy moved out of the house, some people believed that it would be good for marriage, since households no longer served a practical purpose. Marriage could focus now on romantic love and personal fulfillment. But what actually happened? As we should have known, there were unintended consequences. Now, here are five of them. First, marriage has been reduced to a lifestyle choice. Hardly anyone calls it the foundation of our society anymore. Instead, it's merely a matter of taste, and apparently fewer people have a taste for it these days, if the numbers can be trusted. Across the world, the average age of a person getting married continues to go up, even as the percentage of people getting married goes down. Mark Regnerus, a sociologist at the University of Texas, documented that in 1980, that's not too, all that long, at least for me. I was alive in 1980. I was 18 years old, so in 1980. So then, 91% of Czech women were married by the time they were 30 years old. Today, it's just 26%. The trend is the same everywhere. In 1980, 81% of Australian women, 66% of Finnish women, 76% of Italian women, and 81% of Dutch women were married by the time they were 30. Today, it is between 20% and 30% in all those countries. People are experimenting with marriage. There's so-called gay marriage, but that's almost passé. There's polyamorous marriage and open marriage and marriage to vegetation. I heard about a woman that married a tree. And marriage to inanimate objects. I heard about another woman that married a bridge. And many churches are eager to bless all this. Even ostensibly conservative churches focus more on emotional satisfaction in marriage than on the tasks that that marriage historically performed. So that's one. Two, children are increasingly believed to be useless or even bad to have. I'm really glad to hear that we have 60 kids here. I can tell that you guys don't think children are useless. That's great. In my church, I have a family with 13 kids, another with 12, another with 10, and I think like the average family has like six. So I'm used to having lots of kids running around, and we have no nursery and no children's church. So it's just like a family affair, just all around while I'm preaching, just swirling and kids everywhere. It's great. I like it. Anyway, it's a challenge for the preacher. Can I keep their attention? Anyway, fertility is plummeting around the world. This is greeted as something to celebrate by humanitarians. That's a joke. Except in places where they're actually feeling the effects. In Japan, for instance, the population declined by 449,000 people in 2018. And the numbers are going up each year. Even historically, Roman Catholic countries can't sustain their populations. You wonder why the Japanese are into robotics in a really big way? This. They're looking to create mechanical people. Now, everyone knows that kids are expensive. In 2017, the U.S. Department of Agriculture estimated, I don't know why it was the Department of Agriculture, but it was that department, that it will cost $233,610 to raise a child to 17 years of age. Now, I don't think that's really the case. I think, too, that it's worth considering that they didn't think about all the value that they bring into your life. Now, of course, you can't put a dollar figure on that, but you could at least try. You could at least say, you know what, every child that's born into the United States adds to the sort of productive, you know, the sort of the productive output of the United States by millions. But I guess they just didn't think that was worth studying. Besides being expensive, they're likely to hurt your feelings. Have you had your feelings hurt yet by your kids? Dogs are less expensive, and they're always happy when you come home. Except when they've done something they shouldn't do, and they're hiding behind things. But anyway, but even people who manage to have children actually treat them like pets, things to lavish upon but not depend upon. And like a self-fulfilling prophecy, when these children reach adulthood, often you can't depend on them. Number three, post-familialism is on the rise. Since marriage and children are believed to be more trouble than they're worth, people are just opting out of beginning a family. Something has emerged that would have been considered an absurdity in the ancient world, or even the colonial world of our ancestors, the single-person household. I see it especially with middle-aged women that work for large corporations. Many are divorced. By the way, 70% of people who file for divorce are women. I don't know if you knew that. And since many of them have exchanged a family for a career, their social needs are met at work. And rather than challenge this or even question it, some evangelicals, especially in coastal cities, justify it, citing 1 Corinthians 7 and Paul's reflections on the advantages he enjoys of being an unmarried apostle. Oddly, this is packaged with the Reformation doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. But now, instead of priests and nuns getting married, lay people don't. Celibacy used to be for the clergy, now it's for everybody. And it's just so happens that it's also very convenient if you want to climb the corporate ladder and serve the Lord at XYZ mega corporation. Number four, we're sliding into socialism. Now, concurrent with these things, enacting as both a cause and effect, is the growth of the welfare state. It's an effect because people don't have families to fall back upon. And it's a cause because people think they can always fall back upon the welfare state. And naturally, this leads to childless people free-riding the system because the incentives encourage it. Now, that may seem harsh, but do you know how we pay for Social Security? Is there like a big bank account where there's just lots of money sitting around waiting to be doled out to you when you get old or you're out of work? No. It's what goes in goes out immediately. So it's the people today who are paying into the system who are, you know, having their, you know, their tax dollars redistributed to people who paid into the system years ago. That's how it works. So guess what happens when there aren't enough people paying into the system? There are more and more old people, fewer and fewer people paying in. That's the situation that we find ourselves with. Finally, Christians are losing the ability to even think like Christians. The language of our faith is largely drawn from the productive household. God the Father, the only begotten Son, joint heirs with Christ, a bride adorned for her husband, the marriage supper of the Lamb. All of these things tell us what the faith is. What is Christianity left with when we no longer live in households? I think we're beginning to see it. It's reduced to a personal relationship with Jesus and a lot of uncertainty about what families or even churches are good for. Why do I need you? I have Jesus. So what to do? We need to do at least two things. First, we need to get back to the productive household. And second, we need to recover a transcendent point of reference. Now, what I have to say now has to do more with the first of those two things, and what I'll say tomorrow has to do with the second. So that means I'm not going to talk about love languages or anything like that. Instead, I'm going to talk about how to make your household productive. And since this is a practical matter, I'll talk about what we did at my house. And I'm not doing that because we fully lived up to our ideals. Hardly anyone does that. I imagine if you sat down with Rory and Becca and asked them, have you done everything that you hope to do? Is this working exactly the way you dreamed it would? Is there anything that you still have to accomplish? I'm sure they'd say, yes, yes, yes. There's lots of things that we've not been able to actualize when it comes to our ideals. But I'm doing this, talking about myself, in order to show you that the effort is worth it. It's worthwhile, even when you don't fully succeed. So in my book, Man of the House, what I do is essentially mash up the Bible with an ancient manual on productive households from the 4th century B.C. by Xenophon. And it's entitled Oikonomikos, meaning household management or house law. And the things that I recommend in that book would have been considered common sense by everybody in the ancient world, from the Apostle Paul to Seneca. In fact, Oikonomikos was translated by Cicero into Latin. If they had Barnes & Noble, or if they had like Amazon, like Barnes & Noble, people are like, what's that? That's like a physical store where they have physical books. They used to be all over the place. But if that book had been on Amazon or in bookstores in the first century, it would have been, you know, like everywhere. It would have been at the end of the aisle where all the bestsellers are located. Everybody knew about it. So let's take a look at a few things that Xenophon said. One of the things that he said is something that's tremendously incorrect politically these days, and that is men and women have different roles. Now, the natural division of labor of men and women makes men and women depend on each other. And for Xenophon and for people in the ancient world, that's the goal. Independence is not the goal. Interdependence is the goal. So, you know, saying something like, I don't think I could live without you today is just considered to be, you know, sort of like Hallmark, you know, card material. Isn't that a sweet sentiment? For those folks, it was like real. If you die, I'm in a heap of trouble because there are a lot of things I depend on you for that I can't do. Men would say that of women. Women would say that of men. They needed each other. Now, when it comes to children, in the ancient world, they were brought into the work as soon as possible. The idea that that childhood is nothing but a long period of preparation for the labor market, I think, sends the wrong message to kids. It says that important things happen somewhere else. It also says that they have nothing important to contribute to the household economy now. You know, I think that kind of the crisis in terms of, you know, when it comes to the mental health of kids and self-esteem and all that stuff, and I think it has in part something to do with the fact that we don't really rely on them to do anything important. If a kid is entrusted with activities that are really important and really do contribute to the household economy, they have plenty of, you know, sort of objective sort of material to work with when they think about, you know, am I valuable? Yeah. You know, I do all kinds of stuff that's important. You don't even need to think about it. Now, as a pastor, I have something of an advantage when it comes to these things because, generally speaking, unless you're like the pastor of some megachurch, a parsonage generally works on the old model. Historically, the work of the pastor's wife was integral to the work of the parsonage. And children, even children, were included as well. And the expectation of every pastoral search committee until just yesterday was that a pastor's family would work in the church alongside him. Now, here's a thought. You know, I've gone through, you know, interviews, or I've been you know, subjected to interviews to pastor churches and so forth a few times. And the second question, maybe the third question that I'm asked in each of those interviews is, tell us about your wife. Everyone knows that this is a, you know, family, you know, concern. This is something that, you know, you're not just getting the, like if I were to like go to a church and say, well, what are you asking about my wife for? She's not going to come to church with me. In fact, she's not even a Christian. She's an atheist. She's got a corner office over there in the, you get my point. They were like, next. And for good reason. So, anyways, getting back to this, the work of the ministry is conducted as a household. So pastoral families or pastors' families work on the old model. But that's not the only work that we are engaged in our household. I'm an author and an illustrator and a traveling speaker. I've written other books besides nonfiction. I've got fiction stuff I write too. So I've got young adult series of books. I've got children's picture book I'm working on. Hopefully these kids will all read it someday. But anyway, so that's me. I was also a college professor. I taught philosophy for about a decade. My wife is a piano and music instructor, and she has between 25 to 35 students at any time. And she's also a hairdresser. She went to cosmetology school. So our home has a constant stream of people coming through it, like 5 to 10 people every day, you know, just people coming through because of the things that are going on. And our household has also served as a kind of skunk works for the businesses started by our kids. So my oldest son owns his own audio engineering business in Nashville. And he works for, you know, many of the large ministries there. But he's independent. He's self-employed. Before that, he worked for Wheaton College and Fuller Seminary, but he started his business at home. My second son is a steel worker, but in the evenings, he's a welder. He works for United Steel in Hartford area in Connecticut. But in the evenings, he's a blacksmith and a high-end furniture maker. And he also started those things at home. He built his first forge in our garage. Actually, almost burned the house down. Then my daughter is, when she's home from college, she's a baker and a pastry chef, kind of high-end. And so she'll just post on Facebook, I'm coming home, and literally the orders come in, and she'll be in the kitchen for the entire week, you know, making money selling her pastries. And I suppose the reason that our kids are entrepreneurial is because they saw it all the time, and we encourage them to do their own things. And and only work for others as a kind of learning experience, an apprenticeship in everything but name. But I think the biggest thing that really impressed this on our kids, especially the boys, is our commercial real estate. At one time, we had 18 tenants. So we owned property in New England, still have property there. And the boys would help me with renovating apartments and maintaining properties. They saw me interacting with tenants. I probably had 80 tenants over the years. Now, sometimes I paid the boys, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I told them, these apartments will help you pay your way through college and trade school. And they did. And if all goes according to plan, someday you'll inherit them. So just this past week, so about 2 weeks ago, I was back in Connecticut. I was working on one of the apartments. While I was working on the apartment, my daughter was helping me out. She was doing some things around the place. When I left, my second son, who manages our properties there, did a number of things on the apartment. My wife was there just like 3 or 4 days ago, kind of finishing things up for a new tenant. So as you can see, you know, although we didn't have a farm, although we have land in Connecticut, there was property that we worked on together. And that's important to think about. So why don't we think a little bit about property at this point? As you can see from what I've said, a property is what you work with and what you work on. But if you don't own productive property, you work for someone who does. It's the iron rule. Now, you may work for the government, and in that case, you're not in the private, you know, sector, and you know, property is not something that is taken into consideration except so far as it generates tax revenue. But it really is that simple. It's the iron rule. Either you own the property or somebody else does that's being worked on. Now, when I'm talking about property, I'm not talking about toothbrushes or even things you could liquidate in a garage sale. I'm talking about assets that give you a living and keep on giving. Everything from land that you can raise food on to intellectual property. For example, my wife invented a product called the 50-Day Dash. It's a poster that you can use to chart your practice time on a piano over the course of 50 days, and you can buy it in music stores. And as you know, I've written books. That's another form of property. And as I mentioned, we own commercial real estate and businesses, and all of them are productive property. Our tax return is about 30 pages. You know, it takes me about a week. You know, one of the things about, you know, if you even when you hire an accountant to help you, you still have a lot of work to get all the data together. So anyway, I do work with an accountant. So productive property is marvelously variegated. You can turn just about anything into productive property with hard work and imagination. Take silicon, the stuff that we make computer chips from. It's essentially sand. Hard work, imagination, risk, those things have given us smartphones and laptops. Now, you might think those are curses, but they're productive, and they help people do lots of things, and I've been able to use them productively. So productive property is the fruit, or a fruit, of God's image at work in us. Because he made valuable things, we can make valuable things too. You know, and it doesn't take really very long when I, you know, speak to somebody to get into some, you know, stuff or get into to areas where they start to see what they could do that I would never think of doing when it comes to productive property. So I was just with a fellow who works for a high-tech firm that you all know. It's got one of those names that everybody around the world knows. I'm not going to mention it, but he works in the area of speech recognition technology. He makes a lot of money in that area, but he knows that just one slip of the tongue at any moment and he could be out of work. The woke are true believers. You know, if they're really not concerned with things working as much as they are concerned with, you know, promoting their cause at any cost. And it doesn't matter how gifted you are, how talented you are expendable in their eyes. And he knows this. And so as we talked, he said, you know, I really like what I do. And after about, you know, and he presented me with a number of objections to, you know, owning his own business. You know, he wasn't cut out for that sort of thing. You know, after we got all that, through all that kind of stuff, you know, I was able to dig out of him some ideas that are truly his own and could be the source of tremendous wealth for him, you know, stuff that would be property. Anyway, have I got somebody behind me? Productive property, as I mentioned, is something that you want to have. Years ago, productive property kept me financially afloat when I resigned the pastorate in a denomination that I felt was drifting into some dangerous waters. Now, often when pastors face the choice between paying the mortgage and obeying the conscience becomes very pliable. I've seen it. I've felt it. But productive property can support your family as well as your backbone, and that's what it did for me. So when I transitioned out of that pastorate, I just went into, you know, the real estate world and worked the properties that I had acquired over the years. By the way, I acquired those properties while I was a pastor, so it can be done. And this is not true just for pastors. Where there is dependence, there is servility. But productive property gives you a material basis for your liberty. Many of the founders of our country believe that productive property is what makes Republican government possible. That's the real reason they limited the franchise to property owners. The following quote is again from my friend Alan C. Carlson in his book Family Cycles. In his book, The Myth of American Individualism, Barry Shane describes the various notions of liberty extant in the 18th century. Distinctive to America was a strong emphasis on familial liberty. In other words, liberty as a family. By this was meant ownership of sufficient real property, land, and tools to ensure household autonomy. He who would govern himself must own, let me say that again because this is a quotation, he who would govern himself must own his own soul. As the founder, James Wilson, wrote in 1774, men whose property left them subject to the influence of others, quote, have no will of their own, and it is judged improper that they should vote in the representation of a free state. And as Shane summarized, real property was viewed as an instrumental good that made possible familial independence. Now, last of all, productive property is something that you can leave behind. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the sinner's wealth is laid up for the righteous, Proverbs 13:22. Now, people like to say you can't take it with you, and that's true. And it's a good thing since you won't need it where you're going. But it generally is said in a somewhat dismissive way, as though what you have to leave behind isn't worth all that much anyway. But what's been good for you can be good for the people that you leave it to. Now, I've heard that proverb used to justify skipping over your worthless kids so that you can spoil your grandkids. But I don't think that's the point. A household should be a line that runs through the generations. And this is about keeping the line moving, not ending the family concern. So if the things that keep the line moving forward to the third generation include productive people as well as productive property, well, then you had better keep the second generation in line if the property is going to make it to the third. Now, I can't guarantee anything, but I suspect that making your kids productive will help them make productive homes of their own someday. So let me just say a couple things at this point, kind of parenthetically. The first publisher that expressed a really strong interest in the book Man of the House was a German publisher, Herder, Herder and Herder of Germany. And that's the world's largest privately held, family-owned publisher. It's been in the same family for seven generations. Think about that. That property, that publishing concern, has supported that family for seven generations. I actually had the opportunity to meet one of the descendants of the original Herder. She was the one who decided that it would be great for that publisher to publish Man of the House. Unfortunately, the guy who was my editor had a falling out with her, and he became sort of like persona non grata, and everyone associated with him was dropped. So that's how, you know, I didn't end up being published by Herder. But a little closer to home, I'm a man who has three adult children, and her wife and I are now expecting grandchildren. We've got two grandchildren on the way. And our sons married lovely girls, and they own their own homes. So my oldest son owns a home in Nashville, and my second son owns a home in Connecticut. My oldest son is 27, and my younger son is 24. It can be done. You know, we live in a world where people just more or less assume that because of market conditions, that's just too much to expect, but it can be done. But the way it gets done is by raising kids who think in the terms that I'm describing for you. Now, if your line does come to a premature end, it may be because your kids came to think of themselves as the point of it all, rather than just a point on a line that leads to the real point of it all. The real point of it all, of course, is the glory of God. If you start to think of yourself as the point of it all, that's where it all ends. That's why households don't pass on property from generation to generation, because at some point, the point was lost. So go home, put your kids to work, and if what I've said bears any resemblance to the truth, you'll give your kids something worth keeping, and you'll probably keep your kids too. Thank you. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Rory reminded me that, you know, it'd be a good thing to answer questions if folks had them. So I'm happy to do that if I can.
Any questions? I can pass the microphone around.
It's kind of like drinking from a fire hydrant. I know I threw a lot of stuff at you.
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much for speaking and for coming. You talked a lot about the productive property, and I heard in that a strong entrepreneurial encouragement. And I know a lot of amazing entrepreneurs around me, including the Groves. I would not say I have a natural entrepreneurial gift. I am much more, as I heard someone describe it, a cog in the wheel. And I believe that I'm very gifted in following along and helping a vision. What encouragement would you have, and even correction, if necessary, for someone who identifies more in that gifting?
Well, I think that what I tried to describe is a family concern. So not every person, I see I'm blocking that. Not every person in the family, in a family, has the same gifting. I also think that we can maybe make the wrong, I guess, or we can have the wrong expectations when it comes to something like entrepreneurship. We live in a world today where, you know, unless you know, the business that you establish is scalable and can become, you know, something similar to Tesla, you know, that you're not really an entrepreneur. I think that entrepreneurship is something that far more people are capable of than is supposed. But we have to kind of reframe our way of thinking about entrepreneurship. So, a tradesman, a person who owns a small concern. My wife, for example, she's an entrepreneur. She started her own piano business. Now, you know, and if you met my wife, you would not think of, you know, anyone. You would not consider her another Elon Musk. You know, she's very much a, the sort of person that you was, you know, sort of associate with being a kindergarten teacher. And she specializes in little kids, which is perfect in the world of piano because everybody needs to start, you know. So she specializes in beginners. And so she's always got this, like, waiting list. But, you know, she's thought over the years of different ways to sort of maybe even franchise some things that she does. You know, this idea, this product that she created, the 50-Day Dash, is an example of something that just came out of her own work that she thought, wow, here's some intellectual property. Maybe I can make some money with that. So I think, I just think that if we have a different conception of what entrepreneurship looks like, to me, a successful entrepreneur is a person who eats and owns the means by which they eat.
That's good. Any other questions?
This might be kind of silly, but I was just wondering, like, with everything you're sharing and stuff, like, ideas you may have for bringing young children into scenario.
Yeah.
We do have a rental property, so we do let them go pull weeds, but, you know, they think we're torturing them.
Sure.
But, I don't know, just like, yeah, bringing younger kids into that whole idea.
Yeah, I think that in the modern economy, because so many things require, a lot of education, there are just a number of things that kids can't do that would be helpful, say, in like a... So, for example, I've got an elder in my church who has a software company. And I think he hires maybe 30 people, and all of his brothers work with him. and they're pretty much all working from home. Because they can do everything through Slack, you know, and so forth. So it's a very profitable concern. But each of the brothers has a property about the size of this. And precisely for the reason that they have a kind of hybrid approach to this. So, you know, in the ancient world, or, you know, even, you know, colonial America, when your father was a blacksmith, everybody was involved, you know, at some level with that task. But if your father is like a software developer, he's probably just in the other room, you know, typing on computers, and, you know, there's not a whole lot for kids to do. Put some more paper in the copier, that kind of thing, you know, sweep the bathroom. But if you have a property like this, then there are a number of things that kids can do. It doesn't need to be this large, but, I mean, well, here's an interesting little factoid. Cincinnatus, for whom, George Washington was called the Cincinnatus of America. He saved Rome in, I think, the 4th century B.C. He was made dictator, and he had a farm that amounted to about 4 acres. And he was plowing in this field when the representatives of the Senate came out to say, okay, you've been selected to help save the city. And so he did. He went out and he led Rome to victory, and then as soon as he was done, he went back to the farm. And that's what made him such a notable person in the history of Rome. And so the city of Cincinnati is named for Washington, but Washington was named the Cincinnatus because of that guy. But I guess the thing I'm getting at is that you don't really need a whole lot of land in order to do a lot of things that would be really valuable in the sense that they enrich your family. Becca talked about, you know, the food that they made and all the effort that went into making it. But isn't that really a valuable thing? Be able to give kids tasks that they can actually tangibly see, wow, I helped to make this stuff. I think a lot of the time, you know, we try as parents to create work for our kids, and they know it's make work. They don't really see the value of it. Like, go clean your room. I don't mind a messy room. Why do I need to clean your room? Just do what I said. But when you're doing things like this, you know, for example, processing chickens. I saw you have some tractors out there, some, you know, chicken tractors. That's a terminology for, you know, like a little portable coop that you can raise broilers in. So how many did you process here recently?
We did 100 chickens this year.
Yeah, yeah. So you do 100 chickens, there's a lot for kids to do. And you've got not only, I mean, can any family eat 100 chickens? I imagine you sold a bunch.
No, we sold off half the chickens. And we didn't butcher all of them ourselves, but we definitely, each year we butcher a little bit more on site, and then we take, when we've had our fill, we take the rest of them to the local butcher shop to take care of the
rest. It's always a great thing to bring the kid in for the slaughter. You know, okay, now it's your turn, Johnny.
Yeah, we had the chicken tractor stands 2 feet high. So we get our five-year-old to duck underneath there and reach in and grab the chickens by the leg and hand them to mom, who puts them in the cone, and dad, well, we won't.
You know, one of the things that's it's interesting about, I've processed many chickens myself. One of the things is they figure it out after about the fourth chicken.
Exactly.
Chickens aren't coming back. They're leaving and not returning. But anyway, then they become harder to catch. The
last chicken is always the smartest chicken. That's how I view it.
Now, you may not be into eating meat, but you can eat lots of great vegetables, and there are a lot of things that kids can do. You know, you just go over here and look at the gardens. You know, it's great stuff. And you're helping your kids develop, you know, real skills that they may actually really need someday. Now, I'm not end of the world kind of guy, but who knows? They may really need those skills someday.
Great. We have time for one last question.
In giving your model of really highlighting and putting the place of the household in the midst of the kind of the Christian mission, you kind of put like peace and order and success on one, the model that brings it as the household and the household economy. And then productive property is kind of the means to get to that household. And then at the very genesis of that really is the hard work and creativity that you're talking about. There is a lot of ingenuity and wealth in this space here of people. Also, speaking kind of similarly to where my wife was speaking as well, that aspect of creativity, in many ways, it's the thing that a lot of people don't believe that they have in order that leads them to say, well, the first thing that I got to do is to go be employed. And I wanted to know if you identify, is that something that is an on-off switch or just in ranges for different people? And I guess, how would you work with someone who, you know, has it? How would you speak into someone who has it but just kind of needs to be unlocked to see what their potential is?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this gentleman that I was referring to, developed or at least has an idea or the germ of an idea for a new kind of speech recognition technology. During the course of the conversation, I could see that he went from being sort of a naysayer, oh, that could never be, you know, true for me, or some people aren't cut out for that kind of thing, to really excited about, I want to try this. You know, now I'm a believer in keeping your day job. You know, I think that there are certain kinds of high risk endeavors that really require you to have the kind of stability regular employment can provide you with. So, like being an author. Being an author is sort of like being a baseball player. Everybody loves baseball, or many people love baseball. There are millions of people who play baseball, and there are maybe 5 people who make millions and millions of dollars playing baseball. And when people think about authors, it's kind of the same way. There are a lot of people who like to write, but very few people could actually live on the proceeds of what, you know, is, you know, that they create with their writing. So with those folks, even with those folks, you just never know. I mean, you know, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien both had day jobs, you know, and they didn't really kind of see the kind of success that we can associate with them until they were very old, you know, well along in years. So I wanted that kind of, sort of kept in mind when you think about these things. I'm not trying to talk people out of their jobs or get them to quit tomorrow or something like that. What I'm trying to do is promote the idea of owning something that's yours, you know, and that's the key thing. It's something that's yours, that's valuable, that is not only worth the time and effort to create, but also can pay you back for that time and effort, you know, in different ways. When it comes to this whole matter of creativity, I think that it comes about in different ways with different folks. Like for me, most of the valuable things that I've been able to create were kind of almost, this is kind of weird, second thoughts, or, you know, they weren't things that I was really shooting for. Have you ever had a situation like this where, let me give you a weird example. When I was just a new convert, you know, like many new converts, I was very excited about talking to other people about, you know, the Christian faith. And I actually had like a set of people in my mind that I would talk to, and I actually made a list and put a day of the week that I would approach them about the Christian faith. So I worked my way through. It got to the place where I'm sure they were like, oh, it's Wednesday, here he comes, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I was so fixated on those people that I kind of missed, you know, people who actually were interested, because I was kind of preoccupied with these other folks who weren't interested. And a similar thing has occurred for me when it comes to things that I've been involved with. There have been times where, you know, there's been something that I've done kind of over here that I just thought, that's interesting, that could be fun to try. I don't think it'll amount to anything, and it just takes off, just like crazy. And then there are other things where I'm like, I got to do this, I really want to do this, this is the purpose of my life, and it goes nowhere. And you have to be open to making some changes and kind of going with what has got some momentum. So an example of that, I've got a friend named Nate Wilson. His pen name is N.D. Wilson. And he is the guy that is the mind behind the Hello Ninja series on Netflix. I don't know if you guys, it's like a kid show for little kids. But anyways, that was a completely sort of spontaneous thing that he just kind of was a throwaway. Now it's one of his biggest, you know, properties, making, you know, him very wealthy. You know, hundreds of thousands of books and, you know, television show and all this kind of stuff. But it was just one of these things. He had this sort of cute little ditty that he made up for his kids. It was like a rhyme, kind of a Hello Ninja, a little adventure of a ninja. Then he had a friend illustrate it. Next thing you know, Starbucks learns about it and gives it away to like 500,000 people. And boom, you know, so you're like, wow. There's something that's happening over here. I better catch up with it. So things can happen like that.